Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 0100 Zulu June 2nd, or sorry, July 2nd, still stuck in last month, Tangerine SDR session. For those of you on the East Coast, I guess it's 9 o'clock. To start things off, I wanted to make a couple of comments on the discussion last week. I did say something kind of been fretting about all week because something I should not have done, but I did want to say that the files that are used in HDSDR and in PowerSDR WAV files and WMF files, so that sort. Also, I finish off my Audible book, Seeing in the Dark, a few days ago, and I really highly recommend that for anyone who's interested in those sorts of things. And for those who might be listening but later in the week, take a look on Amazon. It's available as an Audible book. It's also as an ebook. I think it's available. So without further ado, we'll start down the list. Dave, KV0S, go ahead.
Well, I'm back from my bout of bronchitis, so feeling a little better, and hope to get back into the swing of things. A couple things. I've been working on reorganizing the OpenHPSDR programmer software with an eye of making it extendable. And so I'm in the restructuring ideas right now on that. Second, the folks in Friedrichshafen, which was a week and a half ago, they had their SDR Academy, and the talks were live streamed, but if you didn't sit there early in the morning on Saturday, you would have missed them. So they're now gradually getting put up on YouTube. The first one, which is more or less an overview and talking of by the leaders of the group to see interest in SDRs, that's up. But there'll be a series of them coming out on their site. The what to look up is on YouTube. Look up SDR Academy. That's that. Now back to you, Dan.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Yeah, I'd forgotten. I actually did read a little blurb about Friedrichshafen. I'd actually forgotten that it was just recent. Thanks for bringing us up to date on that. Dave Whitten, KD0, Echo Alpha Golf. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, all. I have mostly been fooling with JavaScript code and such things this week. Not anything real exciting to anyone, probably, but me. But also trying to track available ARM processors that see what's new and what's going on in that area. Nothing real exciting. Just turn it over to somebody else.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Okay, next we have G. Perry at NJIT, who I believe is our thing scientist this week, is standing. Okay, microphone on. So go ahead.
Hi there, all. Yeah, it's Gareth Perry from NJIT. It's KD2, and this is first really all I'm doing. Just
you're breaking up pretty badly.
Yeah, you may want to switch to box the goals and options.
Well, we have a little bit of dead space here. I think what we'll do is just move on to the list and then come back. So Mike AAAK is shown as recording, and thanks again, Mike, for posting everything. And we'll move on to Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Hi there. How are you? Things are going fine here. I didn't get much done this week because I was away on vacation, so I'm just starting to catch back up with things. But it's good to be back in the group. I think I sent out an email about some of the data being posted from Field Day. I know some people have tried to look at that. I think it's pretty noisy, but I know Tom was having some issues getting that to play, but I think Bill was able to make it work. I do have some summary plots that I'm going to send out soon. Back to the net.
Okay, great. Thanks, Nathaniel. Yes, should be interesting to get that. What kind of reminds me, a few years ago, Vic Keen, N1LT, did the 160-meter contest. I don't know if it was a stoop here, ARRL 160 contest, with a tri-band vertical steered beam system. And he actually used a different rhythm of beams, so he was able to steer a beam around even after the fact, which I thought was an interesting way of doing things. Anyway, and it's something we might think about too. If I don't know if in our application we're going to have to do any beam steering or any phased array work, the option is there. I think the software is there if somebody wants to use it. So it's something to think about. Anyway, moving right along, next on the list is Rick WS. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, good evening. I'm sorry I missed the meeting last week. There was absolutely no excuse. I was watching a good TV show and forgot what time it was. That was disappointing because I think you had a good meeting from looking at the notes. I've not gotten anything new done for this particular project. Working very hard on a series of nuts, and hopefully I'll get that resolved this few days. And living in a rather strange situation, five rooms and a second of my house are empty, as is the hall and closets. And because we're having it all refinished, all the hardwood floors and the paint and everything. And they promised me I'd put furniture back up there. So we're sleeping in the dining room. Oh my, it's quite a mess here. But anyway, looking forward to making some progress. The GPS module, and I have coming to me soon both timing and navigation versions of the dual frequency modules. So at least I'll have them and be able to give some reports on if they actually do us any good. And somebody found a crowdsourced antenna that was less expensive than what I would have to spend if we did do it. So if they can do it on crowdsource, so I'm encouraged by that. And what else? I guess that's all I can think.
Okay, thank you, Rick. Yes, it's always fun to camp out, especially when it's in your house. Sounds like you've got an exciting project. Anyway, moving on down the list, Tom and 5 Echo Golf. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening. Good evening, Dan, and to everybody on the list. Busy week. I downloaded some of those HTTP servers, Ericsson. The bug that I was running into apparently was known and fixed by T, updated to 2.6.8 this afternoon. They put that patch into it. So I'm, after the team session tonight, try updating a digital RF package and seeing it. Secondly, I talked to Holmes, NHZ, going to loan me one of the noise sources the Midwest VHF Society put together as a kit several years ago. It's apparently a very simple device. It's a noise diode fed with a current source, and a 10 puts out a noise it doesn't need. So he's going to loan it to me. I'll run it on HPSDR, which ought to have a noise figure very similar to Tangent. And if that's the case, it's a very simple solution. And that's about it.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tom. We'll go back to the top of the list, and then I'll move down the people we haven't talked with yet. Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Hey, Dan, and glad you're running the show here, and good evening, everyone. Didn't get a lot done this week. Again, hopefully, this being a holiday week, I get some time off, get a chance to do all the things that I've been wanting to do the last couple of weeks, and like get some mechanical details out and get some more work done, the protocol document. I see that now Bill's back. Glad you made it back. Okay, Bill, hope you had a good vacation. We get some interaction with that, at least by next week. I did try to download some of Nathaniel's field day files, but I was having difficulty logging into the FTP server. So maybe I get a little guidance from Nathaniel after we can, because I would like to try and play some of them. And I'm hoping maybe Tom can help me with getting some WAV file conversions once he gets his bug for new radio, because I really would like to pick, you know, a half hour evening time on 20 meters or on 40 meters to give our newbie field day guys a chance to be able to relive field day and learn how to tune the radio and operate. That's about it for the week. Back to you, Dan.
Okay, thanks, Scotty. Moving on down the list, Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, do you copy? I had some trouble on this end.
Yeah, you're 5'9 in North Carolina. Go ahead.
Okay, fine business. Oh, yeah. I found out that the Teams client for Windows doesn't like it if you have your system set up for Flex SDR, because there is such a plethora of different sound and audio drivers, it invariably picks the wrong one. And I suppose I could reboot and do all kinds of things. So I just switched over to using my iPhone. So that's what I'm using now. A couple of things. I did have a question for Nathaniel. I was able to download some field day files and look at them through GNU Radio, because I have a little bit earlier version than Tom. But I had a question for you, Nathaniel. Is there like a carrier, like on those frequencies that are mentioned as being the center frequency? Is there like a carrier there? Because I see a little signal right in the middle of the band. Go ahead.
There's not supposed to be a carrier there. So anything that looks like a carrier is probably an artifact. So that's an issue with that.
Okay. Well, I'm able to get those files, but now if I've got an artifact in there, I'm a little bit fuzzy as to whether I'm really doing everything right. But time will tell, I guess. On this end, I've been playing quite a bit with getting software working with the idea of simulating the data rate we're going to get out of the tangerine by using the red pitaya and then just taking everything and multiplying it to the necessary factors to generate, well, take 48 kilosamples per second, and then you take it and just save it four times, and then you get one channel out of the red pitaya, but you save it eight times. We have discovered, as Tom had earlier thought, perhaps with the case, even the Odroid XU4 is not able to save that amount of data using digital RF, at least in my tests so far. Now, I've got some more stuff I want to do. I'm not sure I did everything right. I have played around a little bit with saving raw binary data, and so far I'm getting good results with that, and which means then another little program to read that binary data and spit it out as digital RF would be needed, which is actually probably trivial. Anyway, making some progress on that. Back from my trip to Scotland, it's a great trip. I'm going to save the best pictures on Shutterfly and post that link, so in case anybody wants to look at it. Okay, back to Ned.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bill. And you were loud and clear through the whole transmission, so it's working good on the old iPhone. Moving right along, we'll go back. G. Perry, NJIT. Give me your first name and call sign again. I'm sorry, I missed it.
It's Gareth, and it's KD2SAK. Does everybody copy?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Perfect. Yeah, hi, it's Gareth from NJIT, and really this is my first meeting, so I'm just listening in and then seeing how everybody's doing and just taking notes. So I'll send it back to the net and let everybody get on with it.
Okay, Gareth, thanks a lot. And I think we'll start now with the open session. So if anybody has any comments, dive right in.
Yeah, Bill, I had a question for you on your XU4 that you couldn't keep up with the stream. What was the format of files you were saving when you were having trouble doing that?
I was using the digital RF packet and saving them that way. And so far, what it looks like is that the CPU time required for doing whatever digital RF does and the saving is more than the XU4 can handle. It is, at least the test I've run so far, running PIHPSDR on the XU4, which works great with the Raspberry Pi, it takes about 30 to 35% of the CPU time in the XU4. And then when you turn, well, all you do is turn on one statement that does the saving of the data in digital RF, and the CPU time goes between 75% and 104%. 104%, that X4% probably is some kind of a computing artifact. But anyway, so I still have some more things I'm going to look into on that. But in parallel, I am evaluating if I'm going to try saving the data just as binary stream. I also have an Odroid N2 on order, 4 gig version, and we'll test with that to see what the results are with that as soon as we get that.
Okay, well, the format you're talking about, digital RF, that's kind of like HD5 only without the headers, is that right?
Oh, it's full-blown HD. It's HDF5. Digital RF, UHDF5 under the covers. So they're not leaving out any headers or anything. They've got standard stuff, the standard metadata they put into the headers.
Okay, so if this works, then this is a full-blown test for HDF5 then.
I believe that's probably a true statement, yeah. I've got a good deal more experimentation I want to do that before I reach a hard decision. We can't use digital RF. And bear in mind that, as time goes on, I would expect probably the work that HDF5/digital RF has to do to save the data is going to remain the same, but the computers are going to get more powerful. So this may not be a permanent thing. It may just be a combination of, you know, maybe some imperfect programming on my part and the power of the particular device I'm using. Go ahead.
Yeah, and what kind of drive are you storing it on? Is it on the SD card or is it on a NVMe drive or what kind of drive?
Well, I've tried it several different ways. I tried outputting the SD card that is actually where the operating system is stored. You got a little bit of extra space because that's where they store their files. So I tried that. I tried storing to a spinning hard drive, and then also on advice from Rick Voltz over at MIT, I set up a RAM disk and tried writing it just right into memory, and the results were about the same in each case. So that what that tells me is the bottleneck is not in the storage mechanism, but rather in the process necessary to prepare the data for storage within the digital RF package itself.
Is that processing load being distributed across the cores in the ARM, or is it just all running on one core or most of it to do that work?
Well, are you asking? I don't know how digital RF/HDF5 handles any internal threading. The Odroid does have multiple cores. I think it's got 4 high-speed cores and 4 small cores or something along those lines. I did try putting each write into a separate thread, but the problem I ran into there, after a couple of writes, it crashes because it's trying to write faster than the processing is getting done, and the different threads are competing for the same some of the same memory space, and so that wasn't. I seem to remember hearing in the past that digital RF/HDF5 attempts to do some threading, but the thing is that it's not inherently threading. The problem is not amenable to being improved by threading because it's basically a serial process. You have to get the data, you have to format it, and then you have to write it out. And all that has to happen in a sequence. Now, you would think that, oh, well, I could write the data in a different thread. But the problem is that it's the preparation of the data that is the bottleneck. At least that's what it looks like from my testing so far.
Okay, well, that might bear looking into further, but you're probably right.
I mean, we could certainly contact the guys at MIT and ask them if there's any multi-threading being done, but you know, when you look at the digital RF package, there are not a whole lot of options. I mean, it doesn't look like you've got a whole lot of fine-grained control over its internal processing. It's pretty simplistic. There's one call that has a few simple parameters, and none of them seem to have to do with any background processing parameters.
Bill, are you able to open a console window on H code is executed?
Yes. That's how I figured out how much power that's how I was able to observe that the processing load was going from 30% to 100% when I turned on the storage. I was using top, not HTOP. Is that a difference?
Well, HTOP, the activity, all of the cores into.
Okay, well, I'll certainly take a look at that. I'll make a note of that.
You'll have to.
Scotty, didn't we buy the XU4 with eMMC?
Yeah, we did. And the N2 also has eMMC memory, or it has an NVMe drive, I believe, and it's I want to say it's a PCIe version, so it's blazing fast.
Yeah, I know with the things that I've done with the XU, having the eMMC is just it's exponentially better than having an SD card.
Yeah, SD cards are. Go ahead, Dave. You probably got a good answer for this.
Well, I'm a little rusty, but I'm not sure that you do have NVMe on the N2s, but you certainly do have a very fast version of eMMC. The alternative is probably USB 3 for large volumes of data, and that, of course, will kick you way down a bunch, but probably a lot of chance there's some stuff to be tuned in all this.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe even if you used each thread and fed it to a different core, you know, that makes it a logical separation. But of course, I mean, if they're timestamped, you still maintain the synchronous nature of the streams unless you wanted to actually interleave them in the same file.
Yeah, it could get pretty complicated at some point. But yeah, it's possible if you had some buffers that could keep things in order.
Streams come up, some that's going to have to be examined the digital time.
And by the way, the N2 does have EMMC 5.0, but doesn't say, yeah, I guess so. That's, I don't know what the speed rating is on that, but that's what the N2 has. And I was going to compare this to the XU4, which is the one that Dan and I have. I think we both have both. Don't you have an N2, Dan?
Yes, I do. I have a not messed with it very much, but it's actually sitting right.
Yeah, it also has an EMMC 5.0. Basically, in fact, I read somewhere that the N2 is only about 30%, maybe 20% faster than an XU4.
Depends on what you're doing with it, but yeah, it's not hugely.
Yeah, because aren't the CPUs in the N2 a little bit more beefy than in the XU4? The XU4 is an Exynos 5422, and I'm not sure what the... It just says A15 2 gigahertz and A78 core. But the N2, I think, is 4 A73s and 4 A53s. Is that right, Dave?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's an 8-core Samsung processor, but the N2 is a AML processor, made from a different manufacturer. There's a board that's recently been released with a faster version, a C revision of that processor by another outfit. I can't think the name right now. And it's running the same pack processor as the N2, but it's running at a little higher speed. And it also happens to have it has a tensor, it has a AI processing module in it as well. I'll try to find that link.
Yeah, okay. The N2 has a quad core A73 and a dual core A53, so it's only a hex core compared to the octa core. But it is an S922X. That's a Samsung CPU, I think. Anyway, I did have a question for Nathaniel. I was trying to download some Field Day files, and I can't seem to get into the server, and I'm not sure I have the right credentials here.
Have you tried today at all?
Yeah, I tried just a minute ago, and using w2naf.d2g.com as the host name, and then the login and password that you gave in the email.
All right, that should work. It's running on a Raspberry Pi right now. I'm actually going to bring over a real computer and put that in instead. So why don't I just send out an email when I have the new server put in and then try downloading it again. I think it'll be a better connection.
Okay, because what I get is access denied. So I'm using the password that you put in the email, which is just hamsci all lowercase.
Yeah, that should work. And I know other people have been successful at getting it.
Scotty, what are you using as the user ID?
Hamsci@w2naf.b2g.com.
And are you using secure FTP?
Yeah, SFTP. I'm using, what's the name of the program here? Yeah, I'm using WinSCP.
Scotty, I have a suggestion. I think this happened to me too. User ID, just use the word hamsci without all the stuff behind the at sign, just the word hamsci. I think all that other stuff is necessary to connect to the server, to pick the server, but not as a user ID. That's just an idea you might try.
That worked. Thanks.
Yeah, I hit that little blockade at first yet as well.
So now I can proceed to overload his Raspberry Pi here.
Okay, so it's working now, Scotty?
Yep, I got in, and I'm just kind of browsing around and looking at the directory structure.
Okay, great. I'll try to keep the downtime on it as low as possible, but if it goes down for a little bit, it should be because I'm upgrading the server.
Oh, okay. It looks like it's just scads of 1.5 meg files, and I don't know, that represents like, 1 minute?
Yeah, I think each one is a minute.
This is amazing. This actually works on the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, it's actually better, you know, reasonably well. I've been trying to do some plotting of the data. I have a Raspberry Pi mounted as an NFS mount on my other Linux machine here, and I've been doing the plotting over the network, and it's actually worked out quite well today.
Okay, so the directories are 2019.06.22, 16-00-00, and 17-00-00. So that's probably 1 hour's worth. So this should be 60 files in each directory. I think there's way more files than that.
It might actually be 1 second per file.
That sounds a lot more likely, because when I took these files and played them back, it didn't take but a fraction of a second to display one of those files if you didn't turn on the repeat function.
Okay, well, it looks real interesting. I'm going to have to see if I can get WAV files from Tom, because I'm not in a position to run a new radio at this point. This is a vast amount of data, Nathaniel.
I know, it really is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, Dave, KV0S, I have a question for you. I'm glad you're feeling better now. I missed you the last couple of sessions. It has a question on the programmer and how the FPGA manages to do its booting.
Oh, okay. So are we talking from like bringing up new, or are you from a working version? So there's a whole process. The bootloader is there. So like the old boards that you dealt with, you and Dan, they would have a bootloader in, and they would have the current firmware in, and the bootloader would be in the lower million memory section, and then the upper meg would be the actual code, and it was set up to run from the upper million, so, or 1 million address on. And so the idea would be, if you turn the radio on and there's some code in that upper set, it would run it. Is that what you're asking, or is there something else?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm asking. But I believe in the Hermes board, it's a Cyclone 4 FPGA. Is that right?
Hermes is Cyclone 4. And, I mean, it does the same thing in Metis, which is Cyclone 3.
Yeah, okay. So that was kind of my question, because, in the IQ2, we have a Cyclone 5. So if I'm going to make it work there, I got to figure out how they did it with the Cyclone 4. From what I understand, I mean, I've been doing FPGAs a long time. When you turn them on, they boot from zero because the memory is reset. So the serial ROM is reset. So they boot from zero. So they're going to boot the bootloader section first, always. Is that's correct?
Yeah, but the if you want, on the GitHub, all the bootloader code is there, Quartus code, and all of the actual radio code is there. They're two separate pieces, but you should be able to look at what's going on in those. For the Hermes, I would probably look at the Angelia, which is, again, a Cyclone 4, but a little bit newer. What happens is people work on the newer radios and then backport it to the older radio.
Yeah, okay. I'm still trying to understand, how it actually can. I mean, what's the order in which the images boot? Okay, because I originally thought, well, it's always going to boot the bootloader. Then it's the bootloader. The first thing it does is it checks to see if there's code above 1 million. And then if there is, then it goes and it loads that. But the question is, how does the FPGA do that? Because I know there's on the Cyclone 4 on the Hermes board, there's a reboot pin. So under FPGA control, it can kind of kick itself in the rear again and reload. But how does it end up loading the second image? I'm not clear on that.
Well, I don't know, because I didn't write that. That would be either Phil would know how that works, and or this Rick N1 GP. Now, Rick, I found out, I sent him an email in the last 2 weeks, and he said that he's doing two big jobs at work and doesn't have time to answer any questions right now. So, and Phil just went on vacation, so you're kind of stuck for a little bit.
Oh, so I'm going to have to go read the code. I was hoping to avoid having to dig in, but I think the way it really works is that there's Altera IP that you place in the part that gives you control over the serial loader. serial ROM and send the instruction counter basically in the serial ROM. And I think that's the way it works, because I remember when I was trying to port the Hermes code or the Angelia code up to a Cyclone 5, that module changed in the Cyclone 5, and it's no longer just drops right in, which really kind of a nuisance, because you got to go back and figure it out and fix it.
And I think that's why they didn't change to Cyclone 5s when they became available, because it was too much of a hassle to recode all that.
Yeah, and this is going to be much easier on the Tangerine, because we're using a Max 10, and it already has two built-in images. And in fact, it has automatic fault detection, so it'll load the first image, and if that bombs off and it can't load it because the chuck sums bad or some such thing, it just automatically reverts to the other image. So the alternate image, you just put the bootloader in and you never erase that. And then new code goes in the first image. And if that doesn't load, then you get the bootloader, and then the bootloader can go reprogram the memory for the first, the primary partition.
Yeah. And the general idea is you make a bootloader and you put it in and you don't ever change it. And that was the one thing that, Phil being the main person doing the coding, he put in a MAC address that was, kind of a naive MAC address and will not go through routers. And we had one user that wanted us to change it, but the trouble was you could change it on his machine, but it was a nightmare to change it on all radios.
Well, and in light of our architecture, I'm not sure that you really want it to be programmable across the network. I mean, you'd want to restrict it to a network security reasons.
I would agree. And this was somebody that had an HP or a Cisco network in his house. He knew enough about that he wanted it a certain way. And we said, well, you're not the average user. Just fix it yourself.
So did he?
No, he just, when he needs to use a bootloader, he wires the radio to the computer.
Okay, not a bad solution, since I think that's what we're going to. I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, you could, if you want to have the remote control protocol that allows a new image to be pushed up to the single board computer, then let the single board computer reprogram the data engine. That would be okay. But then we would get all of the protection of remote control, the RCC protocol, that would give us security and encryption and whatever else, would protect DEs from getting hacked.
Yep. And so that's the general process. And actually, Rick was asking a question on the open HPSTR list. He has a meta set, and a meta set is kind of weird because we wrote Ozzy first, and Ozzy was a USB board. So then we went to Metis to use the Ethernet board. And when we did that, Metis was the only thing that could be programmed directly. And so then you had to turn your Metis board into a JTAG programmer to program the other boards. And that's always been coming for most years.
Yeah. And you had to pull all the boards out and put the board you want to program right next to Metis and put the last JTAG jumper on it and use Metis as a programmer.
Yeah, and it needed to be in the sixth bay, the furthest from the power supply for the Metis, and then the board you were programming needed to be right next to it, closer to the power supply.
Yeah, because the JTAG flowed back toward the power supply.
Yes, that's right. And it all makes sense if you actually comprehend what's going on, but it's confusing. If it's really hard to write a set of instructions that help people understand what's going on, because it's usually more than they want to know. They just want the thing to work.
Well, and if they don't read it, then it didn't do any good.
Yeah, that was my attempt to explain some of that in that DCC talk, but I don't know if it really did that.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. It's like we Dan and I were supposed to be the most knowledgeable ones, and we struggle with that, right, Dan?
Every day.
Well, the thing is once you get a system going and you just do it the same way over and over, you can repeat that pattern very easily.
It's building the first pattern that's the problem.
Yeah, I know.
Well, so anyway, Tom, I'm going to, I still want to read over your spec there, and then I want to add this mechanical information to the Tangerine spec, and I think that's probably where it belongs, and then we can maybe get something moving again. So I feel like I've been stalling here and I'm not pulling my own weight here.
Yeah, that's fine. Just trying to make sure that we've got the right definition. I'm going to start trying to dig into a few of the other aspects a little bit. There's about six tasks. It's hard advancing at the same. One of the things that I've thought about is that, you know, the FPGA is going to have to time tag the data frames. I think it's also going to have to look at the status receiver. If the GPS receiver is out or something, it's going to also have that status with the time information. So we've got a whole bunch of different.
So do we need a status, hardware status pin saying lock, or can we do it with an I2C register?
Well, or we may be able to do it in the data frames themselves. We're going to have, besides put packets that Tangerine sends host, we're going to have bytes in there, the exact go down to 60 header as well. That's a kind of a status button. And that way it's status.
Comment.
Go ahead.
This is Rick. There is an awful lot of status available in the GPS module, more than you want to know, obviously. One model or what status seems to be interesting is at the NT frames. There's a number of things in there that convey some idea of status, not particularly GPS status, but for instance, GPS stratum will automatically be lowered if the GPS is not in lock. And also a bit that is particularly interesting, woefully misunderstood, is leap second, which leap seconds tend to be things that people who like timestamps do not like very much. So at the very least, they like to advance when they're coming. Of course, there were NTP leap second pending, and the rules for ICD-200 GPS leap second pending are totally different. But nonetheless, if you want information like that available, but it has to be planned ahead, you won't get it.
Well, so the idea is that you're gonna timestamp the packets, but then you really want to know, like, well, is the GPS out of lock? Is it in holdover mode? Is the oscillator? I mean, what's the quality of that timestamp?
Yeah, and there's a variety of ways to provide some quality information. The GPS tends to a set of DOPS, dual precisions, give you some idea of the quality of navigation and timing solutions, but they aren't necessarily where NTP just said, oh, how good is the source? So this is stratum versus, and if GPS is out of lock, it automatically reduces its stratum reading NTP. And there's a number of other ways that can be done, but it's something that's not GPS model specification. Why interested kinds of it want?
Well, I'm interested in how we're going to get that information from the GPS, whether it's going to be a hardware line or whether it's going to be some kind of status that we read or an interrupt, or how are we going to get it?
Well, we have flexibility up to a certain level. I think we have more pins, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think we do. And that's where I was going with this is I really want, if we're going to build a data engine and build it before we build a clock module, then we're going to have a pin out of the clock module defined before we build the data engine, because otherwise we won't be able to build a clock module.
I think the problem we have right now is we've written a requirements spec, not an ICD. We need to start with
ICD being the interface document.
Interface control. I assume we're going to those. That's where you define all the pins and the power requirements and the physical size, where the screws go, all the various physical and electrical interfaces. At least that's how I do it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and
I'm just advising.
Yeah, and I have a document reserved to do that. It's, I think, in the original spec. I called out names of documents that were non-existent, but that we have planned because we got to have them.
Yeah, the ICDs are for any module interfaces.
Yeah, so we'll need an ICD for the RF module also.
Yeah, if it has a connection.
So what a concept, actually designing the documents before the hardware.
I try not to show the fact that my career is building hardware for the government, but, you know, that's how it's done. Yeah, you build the documents top.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the best way if you want to get it right.
Well, if you want to actually pay any attention to what you're trying to do, which is called requirements, and then way down from there, where I get in trouble is everybody, including me, much prefers to bottom up because we already know what microprocessor, what FPGA we want to use, which turns out to be totally irrelevant. The requirement spec should be driven by the requirement spec, but So it's quite common to do a design bottom up and top down at the same time and have them not meet very well. But
yeah, I know that because I know basically the hardware design spec that I wrote up is the bottom up. So it's saying, okay, these are the parts we're going to use. This is how we're going to connect them. And we just haven't drawn the schematic, but we kind of know how it's going to go. But that doesn't say it's going to meet any of the requirements. So we got to kind of back off and start from the top down and make sure they.
And of course, I'm sitting with the Altium Designer latest version with all the options ready to go and lay out PC boards for the requirements spec. Just like I want to get to work.
Yeah, it is so tempting, isn't it? Well, but this is good. I mean, you have something to say, Tom?
I was just going to say the clock my first month started. We've done a requirements document, which has got these in it, and it may be the first one try to nicely. It'll give us some experience, and it's the one Rick and I have to look at it, and then Scotty has to look at it. So it's most folks who have.
Yeah, and I think after talking with John Ackerman, we're thinking that that might be a Tapper design product in itself, because he's all set to do a baseboard for it when we come up with the design or come up with the ICD, so that you can actually take the module and use it on a tangerine board or use it on a standalone, time nuts application, a little carrier board.
Yeah, I think the way it's defined, it would sell very well. It's a mirrored oscillator synthesizer. That is a fantastic product for Tapper.
Yeah, and then the fact that we could use it right into the tangerine for space weather station would be awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll take a note. We will look at the clock module for writing the first ICD. Scotty, if you get a chance to look diagram in that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I did take a cursory look. It looks good, but I got to sit down and stare at it and ponder it for a while and see if there's anything that I can come up with that I can add.
Okay, very good. I'll try to throw something together. It looks nice and Rick, make sure that it's a comprehensive, useful.
Yeah, keep in mind the requirements document, as it's currently written, focused on the space weather station, but anyone who's got an adjoining module and some idea what they want to do with that might want to have additional requirements added at the highest level of requirements. If there's something you think you're going to need, you better speak.
Okay, well, we may want to run the requirements and the two other occasions than most folks.
Well, yeah, except I already heard something this evening. Some need to provide status, another consumer, that's not in there, right? So that actually needs to be in the requirements document, not just in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the ICD, I'm thinking, is going to really be a tangerine SDR clock module for that, because that's what the module's going to be. It will be used for space weather station use, so the requirements for PSWS have to be enumerated, but the ICD is going to be for the tangerine board, I think. Is that right, Tom?
Well, the ICD should specify, like Rick was saying, kind of connectors on the connector, what signal those pins. And so in that sense, you need that information as well when you do.
Right. So, I mean, the argument would be, well, it doesn't have to be a tangerine clock module. The tangerine system could use that as a module. I was just kind of branding it that, because that's going to be the first use.
Yeah. But Rick brings up, we shouldn't short sell usefulness of applications. Different applications, at PSWS app, we still mention the ICD.
Well, and ideally what I would like to see is several different applications or for clock modules, different ones, and several different requirements documents, and then make sure the ICD can meet all of those.
Okay, so that a situation with use cases. I have a use case. I was thinking one single meets a superset of requirements if it doesn't add cost.
Yeah, and I was thinking that there would be a case where there would be no clock module and use a low-cost onboard oscillator, and then there might be an intermediate-level clock oscillator, which might be an oven-controlled or a VCXO. And then there would be this one for personal space weather station, which would be a GPSDO. So there might be two different modules and three different configurations, one of them with no module.
Right. But the clock module itself has a space to allow it to plug into tangent. And then you would probably have to look at that connector and say, ways could you also cost mod that fits the same connector?
With a little creativity, we might be able to use the same PCB with different bill of materials and solve.
Yeah, that was one of the goals, but it depends on what the requirements are. And so
we really need to understand
use cases and then go from there.
So it's an iterative process. I suspect in writing the ICD, they see things that should be incorporated in the requirements as you start uncovering, and that's fine. You just keep modifying the higher level specs and cover requirements. And
yeah, exactly.
Build your ICD. They go hand in hand. It's an iterative process, so nothing wrong with that.
Yep, that's kind of what the purpose of all these discussions are, is to throw it out there and say, okay, this is what it's going to do. And then like today, oh, well, how are we going to handle the status? We have to figure that out.
Yeah, well, at least we have a start requirement stock can start. I'm taking notes here. I'll send the notes out and get started on trying to add some sections.
So you're thinking we'll have a clock module ICD, we'll have a clock module requirements, and then we'll have a use case document, so three documents, or will the use cases be in the requirements?
I vote for the use case being a requirement because we don't want to write too many documents. I view use case customers. Who are the clock modules customers? Appers got another application. They want to be a customer on some bear board. And Tangerine is a customer. Maybe it's more than one customer because it has a world to fill itself. But anyway, I see all of that and discover it in the requirements document. That would keep
okay, so Tom, you've got the start of the requirements document, and the ICD will come forth out of that.
Yeah, I'm taking notes. I agree with Rick. I think at least for the clock, the use cases doesn't need to be separate. I don't even the ICD needs to be separate, but one versus two too much extra.
Well, I like the ICD being separate from the requirements document than the use cases, and then actually I see a third document that might be made or might not be made when we get down the road, and that would be a design document that says, okay, given all that, now what are we going to actually make? And that's like the design document that I did for the data engine, which is kind of jumped the gun and kind of skipped the first two phases. but you know, when you get down to it, it's like, okay, well, which part are we going to use on this module? Or maybe we're going to have three modules, and which parts are we going to use the three? And that would be a design document designed to all meet the ICD, and all different modules perhaps would satisfy the multiple use cases.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, we don't get too many documents here. You know, I see one for clock module, I see one data engine, I see one, and one for the magnetometer. So hopefully we just have clusters. Do you know of other ones we need?
No, because I'm thinking that the, and perhaps with the magnetometer, it might be included also. I'm thinking of standard interface. So we'll define on the DE, we'll define I2C, SPI, UART, or maybe an RS-485 interface, whatever standard interfaces there are. And then the devices that you hook up, as long as they meet the hardware standard interface, then they just become an exercise in FPGA programming to talk to it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad that Dave gave me the pointer to all of the information on it. Looks like it'll have it onto a small RS-485 or some face, a lot of protectors to.
Yeah, and this might actually be another product in addition to the clock module, because I'm thinking what it's going to have to be mounted remotely. So you're going to want to put RS-485 transceivers or driver on the module itself, and then you're going to want to have an RS-485 receiver at the other end at the data engine. But I really don't want to put RS-485 drivers on the Tangerine board, so we can use a standard interface like a PMOD, but the PMOD has unprotected inputs, so you're going to want to put a little paddle board that has all your ESD parts and your RS-485 receivers that plugs right into the Tangerine. And then the two paddle boards, one with the magnetometer on it in an NEMA enclosure, a wire, and the plug-in board, that would be something you could sell, because PMODs are standard. You can hook that up to an Arduino if you wanted.
Okay. Well, that would be something small would seem an easy doc. I'm not familiar with, you know, how you move an I2C or an SP face over distance, use level versions and time and phasing. There's other parts you have.
I just use a UART over RS-485 and run it at 100 baud.
100K.
Well, I want to be able to run it for a few hundred feet. So how fast can I go?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So with RS-485, you can get up to, I don't know what the limit is, but a lot of feet if you're willing to tolerate a really low baud rate.
How many samples per second do you want?
One reading per second is what I'm hearing. Is that what you're hearing, Tom?
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to need to make a bunch of readings and average them. If the chip, all the averaging, you know, I asked Dave, had some of, and so now it's on. If that cable length, I don't know that 100 kilobaud is is too fast. It depends on you run an Ethernet cable at 100 megabits per second.
Yeah, and you get, what, 105 meters of that.
Right, so if the length of the cable needed to be shorter than meters, you may be able to achieve it. Okay, my notes list is starting to grow here.
Okay, well, good.
I'm trying to get around to testing that evaluation board that our whatever it was, module for the RF, for the that module anyway. But I haven't quite got there yet. It doesn't come with the API is all written out in specifications, so I'm going to have to sort that out into some C code or something.
Okay, so the only thing it lacks is documentation.
Well, it's got documentation. It just doesn't have an easy to use C library or something that is pre-made that I can quickly just hack out. But I can. It's probably simpler than it seems right now. I just haven't got to it.
Oh, okay. I understand.
I was just wondering if it talks UART or SPI or what's the actual serial protocol?
It's I2C or SPI.
Okay, so we'd have to extend that with RS-485, and that's, I think Mike made a statement about 45. It sounds like 100K would be doable, even at 100 meters.
I don't know how far you want to extend this. I've always used I2C at a few feet without any problem, but I've never tried to set any, speed records.
Yeah, and since you're going to have to put the magnetometer out in the backyard somewhere, away from the house, away from power lines, away from other objects, I'm guessing that, I'd rather say, okay, we're going to run at 50 baud and we'll allow you 4,000 feet. Or if we run it a megabit and we limit it to 100 feet, what happens to the poor guy who wants to put it 200 feet? So you make it some phenomenally long length, because at one reading per second, who cares? Make it slow.
You may be able to strap it to one of the cheap Wi-Fi chips that cost $5 these days and have enough, and then add some intelligence and just use it as a remote that way.
Yeah, so put a battery holder on it and a Wi-Fi chip, see how long your battery's. I mean, there's certainly lots of precedence for the IoT area for doing something like that.
Yeah, I've got a lot of that stuff, but it's pretty frustrating to work with.
Yeah, there's something nice about it. It's certainly the less computers talk. At any rate, we're getting a little bit late. I'm going to have to leave the session a minute.
Yeah, I think this is a good breaking point. We're trying to keep them under an hour, which we haven't been successful in doing once a bunch of techie guys going.